As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Ruck Special. This week, there were two Rucks. The second Ruck involves just Stuart, Barnes and myself, alone in our studio. We're going to talk about a literary effort, because Stuart's produced his new book. It's called Sketches from Memory, a Rugby Memoir. It's published by Polaris of Edinburgh, and it is a very, very different book indeed. As Stuart says at the start, it's got no beginning or no end. It's got no beginning, no end, no sense of chronology. And he calls facts false gods. False gods. Stuart, you and I and our sub-editors have been desperately smashing down on facts for years. It's all we ever do. It's our whole raison d'etre. And you're saying now facts are false gods in your book.
I'm saying that over a broader period of time, Steve. When we're covering a game on a Saturday night, then who did what in what time is a fact. But when you are looking back over the broader spectrum of the game, I believe we become obsessed with facts, in particular statistics, and we lose our sense of feeling. And I feel that what makes sport different from life is the fact it is a game. And we can feel our way through it. And by that, it's a sense of emotion. It's a visceral gut instinct to the game.
But surely a chronology is needed in any book, because otherwise, in the who done it, you're going to have the murderer found before he's killed anybody.
Well, I deliberately avoided a chronology because I feel so many sports books... And you're right, it's a memoir, it's not autobiography. So many sports books have the great moment at the end, occasionally a lower moment, although in autobiography they tend to be the higher moments. And I wanted to avoid that because, you know, it's not about me. I'm a protagonist that sort of walks through 40 years of rugby, which is my lifetime in the game. So what I'm trying to give the reader is a sense, almost a sort of, a sense of history of where the game has gone in a sequence of shards, with me just being there on the inside, if you like, trying to explain. For example, you know, when I write a chapter about France, I'll do it from the sense of being against Philippe Seller with Serge Blanco running at you in the Parc de France, and try and give you an idea what that feels like, so you get an inner sense of what it is like to be a competitor, to be immersed in the game, but also the broader journalistic sense, because obviously I've been writing and commentating an awful lot longer now than I have been playing. But I played, I think, at a reasonable enough level to still have a sense of the history of the game from the ground level.
I think where I do agree totally is that the normal rugby book is really in painful sequence and painful chronology, because it starts off with your mum, then your school teacher and all that, and it's very difficult to...
It's an easy formulaic way to do it,
isn't it? But it's difficult to get across to authors, don't start like that. Yeah. If you want to put that in, put it in the last chapter or so, or something like that. And it does work well. I have to say that I don't want to put anybody off with my intro, because it does work extremely well, but you really have to buy into what Stuart's doing in terms of the philosophy of it and the rhythm of it. Did you enjoy writing the book? People said to me, either hate it, like I do, absolutely hate it, detest it, or did you love it?
I like writing more than I probably ever liked playing. It's 110,000 words, your life, your subject. You think, well, you can't do anything but like it. But weirdly enough, I found it quite difficult. The writing of it I enjoyed, but I felt that because I wasn't dealing in facts, Steve, that I wasn't Googling or going to rugby books to see what date, what time, what person, I was having to go a long way back in my own mind, and I did find sections quite difficult. You know, I wrote a section about my school, your school, Baysleg. And
or Baysleg,
Basarleg,
as you call it.
Yeah, Baysleg, Basarleg. Yeah. And it never crossed my mind that I was anything but the sort of rugby star, head boy, heading for Oxford. And I was thinking about it, and I started to realise why people who weren't sort of reasonably academic, who weren't sporting, might think, what a prat this bloke is. And this happened on a number of examples. I delayed writing my chapter on Bath, the recreation ground, and I didn't know why. And then I got down to it, and I always thought that Bath, for me, was my spiritual home. The people, the fans, everything. And I started to write it, and I was wondering, was I actually going to Bath and trying to make it my sort of theatre, my plaything? I think by the end of it, I'd come out of it the right way. But these things worried me, and that sent me in a slightly other direction as well, which is memory. This book has large sections about memory and the fact that you get to a certain stage in your life and you wonder, have I forgotten it or have I rewritten it? And when you're writing memoir and you start to think, is this a rewrite? It gets quite interesting, and it also gets not depressing, but alarming. And I must say, I probably wrote 6 or 7 drafts of it. And I'd say by about draft 3, I was feeling pretty down about myself. And by 7, I was thinking, well, there's probably other people in the world who've done worse things, but it was not an easy write, no.
But you were a famous, every time I introduce you at a function, I always say, introduce you as Judas, of course.
Yeah.
But you did turn your back on what could be called the old country with Wales, because you didn't really lap it up. You didn't feel like one of the valley boys ever. But when you went to England, according to the book, and for what you told me, you didn't feel much like one of those either.
Oh, right.
And then when you went to Bath, you were part of the greatest team they've ever had. But actually, you used to fight people in the dressing room and afterwards as a result. So you weren't actually that bothered to fit in. Well, I think you were a team bloke. But, I mean, you didn't bother. You know, you're almost saying that you hardly ever spoke to Jerry Guscott till he'd retired, sort of thing. So there's one common denominator in all this. It's you.
Yeah, I agree, Steve. And again, the other thing, and the common denominator within, which I think I found out in the writing of this book, was this fear of failure. And I could always, from the age of 11, make excuses. I was meant to be the fastest kid in school. First year at Baysleg or Basarleg, we did the 100 metres on that old grass track, you'll remember. Mm. I deliberately slipped at the start out of the blocks of the 100 metres because then I'd have an excuse for losing. And by the time I got to Bath, I think I'd channeled it more. But I think fear of failure may well have played a part in me getting so uptight about not getting picked for England that twice I quit. Fear of failure might have played a part when I got dropped by Newport for a cup tie against Swansea when I was 18 for saying hell with this and leaving. And again, that's all part of what sort of person was I really? And you're quite right. I was the common denominator in all of those things. And I loved winning, but I was so scared of losing that I think that I and Bath, who were made for each other because Jack Rowell was an inveterate winner, I look back on it now and I think all those leagues and all those cups at Twickenham that we won, I'm thinking, had we had a little bit less fear, a little bit more ambition, we might have lost the odd game. We'd have probably won as many trophies and we'd have been an even better team. And that was just one of those themes. And I when I read books and when I hear people talk about sport, I hear this thing, fear of failure drives. And I came out of this book thinking, it's nonsense. You have to take yourself beyond that. And I was one of these guys, when I stopped playing, I scoffed at sports psychologists. I now wish to hell that Bath had had one when I was playing, because I think that players like myself and a few others, it would have made us so much more positive.
What I can't quite get from the book is that the famous stat where Rob Andrew got 1,000 caps, you got 10. You're saying that you now wish you didn't see anything in sports psychology. Do I detect in the book any growing anger with yourself that you didn't play the game that they wanted you to play?
Yeah.
By that, I mean you had to be a great mate to Jeff Cook, Roger Utley, Will Carling, the RFU. You couldn't be a sort of Bath man who'd come up. You had to embrace it all. Do you now wish you'd embraced it?
I couldn't do that, Steve. I mean, it's easy now, age 56, to say, I wish I'd kept quiet. I couldn't be that. I think the biggest problem, really, I wish I hadn't made it so obvious. Let's put it that way. But it was difficult, and it wasn't until you became part of the England setup, you realised the cultural chasm that the Severn Bridge separated England and Wales. You know, I came from a culture where decision making and playing with heads up with everything, and as a Welsh schoolboy and someone's in the Welsh squad, you never had big forwards in front of you then. You never had big forwards, so you had to be very quick of wit. And I think that explains the phenomena that is John, that is Bennett, that is Davis. You had to be quick-witted. And I'm not putting myself in that category, but I saw the game in that way. And I came to England, and when the game went professional, in particular, England had all these great big forwards, and they worked out that they could shut down teams like Wales. And what do you think about it, Steve? From 60 to 80, England could hardly beat Wales. When the game went professional, we had that incredible run, didn't we, for a while, when Wales were getting hammered by England, because England understood what they needed to do, and that was play to their strength, which was the forwards. And what I do wish I hadn't done...
Is that what Eddie Jones should be doing now? That, in my opinion, that's what he should still be doing,
Steve,
play to their strength.
To me, Eddie Jones's finest hour in England was when they lost, funnily enough, to New Zealand. But for 25 minutes, he had... runners one off, and they battered New Zealand, and that's the way to beat the All Blacks, to take them on physically. And I think that's what England should be doing. I think a change in subject is why Eddie would be mad not to look at someone like Alex Dombrandt, because he has that capacity to come off the bench and change the game as a carrier. But my frustration wasn't the fact that I didn't keep my mouth shut and do it the English way. It's probably that I didn't recognise it, and it lent itself to an air of petulance, because what I recognise now is, I still think, and this is not arrogant, because I'm certain if you ask Rob Andrew, he'd say I was better than Stuart Barnes. If you ask Stuart Barnes, he's going to say I'm better than Rob Andrew. That's just the competitive nature of the game. But what I didn't recognise was perhaps that where Rob Andrew was better than Stuart Barnes were the areas where England were at their strongest. I feel, and I still think, that where England lost out was there was a lack of fluidity to their thinking. I think it cost them the 1991 World Cup. And I address in the book how at a team meeting at the Petersham Hotel the night before a game, you get someone like Dick Best saying, right, we're going to win a line out here, we're going to throw it in the midfield, then what? And I was called off the bench, so to speak, because I was a sub, and said, what are we going to do? And I said, well, what I'm going to do is look and see where the split of the defence is. And
they
just
said,
about everyone in the team sort of laughed at me, because, no, haven't you been listening? I said, well, I've been listening, but I'm going to see where it is. And to me, that summarised the issue, and to an extent, it still does. We're still not on a par with Wales when it comes to the intellect of the game. And that's why you see so many smart Welsh sevens and so few smart English sevens, because seven is that conduit between forwards and backs, and that's where intellect really comes into its own.
I'm not sure whether Wales are now catching up in the over programmes takes, but there we go. Let's just go through one or two specific parts of the book. One chapter I thoroughly enjoyed was a sort of hymn you produced to the drop goal, which I just can't remember the last time I saw one. And I still can't believe. I mean, people say these days they're sniffy about, oh no, that's old hat. Well, it's not old hat,
because
you can drop a goal or you can get 3 points without the other team infringing and without getting anywhere near their line. It's the easiest 3 points going. Your hymn to the drop goal. You mentioned a few great ones. One of which you kicked yourself. And was that what was the motivation in that? Just the intrinsic, fantastic skillness of it, or people, or the fact that you're trying to bring it back?
I think it's a great art form within the game. I also wanted to do something that hasn't been done in a book form before, which was take about 4 minutes of commentary, quite literally, Mark Robson and myself, and go through that Nick Evans drop goal against Stade Français, wasn't it? Which, to me, is the greatest concerted combination. More than a drop goal, Steve, that drop goal in the mud when the forwards were just ploughing on was the most perfect summation of why rugby is a great game. And it's not just about chucking it out to your wings and sprinting at 100 miles an hour. It's about being able to keep the ball, to be patient, to have the courage, to trust one another, and then your main man do it when it happens. And Evans was a very underestimated player. And I love that because that told me so much more about rugby. I also think the drop goal is a fascinating topic. As you said, people will say that's old hat. People who say old hat are people who don't understand history. And if you don't understand history, be it in politics, war or rugby union, you don't understand the subject you're dealing in. You know, it will come back. It's not that long ago that Yanni De Beer dropped 5 goals to beat England. They're worth 3 points. To say it's old hat when it's worth 3 points, when it's 60% of a try, when defence is so much better, man for man, yet a drop goal remains even easier perhaps because the pitches are better, then it's sheer lunacy. And I wanted to celebrate the greatness of the drop goal, but also ask the question about why isn't it being done? And intellectually, why the hell are the people that are in authority in the game not saying, let's bring this down to 1 point because it's too damn easy? So the drop goal for me, Steve, was it was about history. It was about a wonderful moment because I really enjoyed the commentary of the Nick Evans thing because I was so into it. Some of the great moments, but also some of the pitfalls that is the administration of rugby union, which is an inability to follow where rugby league goes, which I touch on in a later chapter called Up and Under.
Just one more thing about the drop call, and you talk about the motivation for one of your more famous ones when you were basically towards the end of a cup final against Quins, you were down and the drop call would have done it for you, but you're a long way out, and a certain person next to you said, "Look, if you're not going to have a shot, give me the ball and I'll do it." And so you kept it, had a shot, and won the game.
But again, doesn't that tell you how wonderful rugby can be? Harlequins plotted this thing of beauty, and in the chapter as well, and I had to do a rewrite because it was off with the publishers before last year's Six Nations started. I then came back and did fairly substantial rewrites. The Johnny Sexton drop goal, a thing of orchestrated beauty. Then you compare it with the Bath Harlequins when we were 100 minutes into it, and I was absolutely knackered, and you're quite right. I wanted to go with an up and under. I wanted Phil de Glanville to chase it because Jerry Guscott never chased balls. It was beneath him. And it was Jerry who, hands on hips, I said, "Chase this kick." And he said, "No." And I said, "Just chase it, Jerry." He said, "If you ain't got the balls to go for it, I will." At which point, Jerry knew what my ego was like. So I said, "Well, sod you, Guscott. I'll kick it." It got over, and that was typical of Jerry. Jerry was also, may I digress briefly? Jerry was very important to me because we started off, Jerry wanted to be Bath fly half, Horton left, I came. He couldn't stand this, what he thought was this upstart Oxford bloke who was quite young, so it was going to ruin his chance of being the Bath fly half. And I think on his stag night, we ended up brawling in some Bath nightclub.
With Jerry, that was.
With Jerry and myself. And there were not many first teamers there, and I couldn't understand where are all the first team. What I've understood about Jerry is Jerry stayed true to his old mates, and I loved him for that. He only invited me because he wanted a fight. And that broke the ice, and Jerry became very important in my sporting life. You know, there's the drop goal, which was, you know, famous certainly in Bath history. But he did a big thing for me because he probably got me in this very room today, because I wanted to have I was in retirement from England, my second Greta Garbo leave me alone moment, and we were training at the wreck, and it was at Lambridge, and it was muddy, something happened and the ball came back to me on my left foot and I dropped a goal from about 30 metres. Flew through the post, been training at Bath because Bath was like my fiefdom and I was absolutely confident in everything I did. Jack had made me his sort of emissary on earth. I sort of said, well, of course I can do that. And Jerry turned to me and he sneered in that Jerry way and he said, it's a pity you can't do that when you're not in your own backyard at Bath. Why didn't you ever go with England?
Well, these are the two close friends. You two can wreck your own stag day by having Barnsley come and beat you up at it. So that was a good... I enjoyed that chapter too. You're listening to The Ruck. We'll be back with Stuart Barnes, author, in a minute.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
And welcome back. You're not very... you can be very annoyingly non-effusive, Barnsley, but you do confess in the book to several love affairs. One is the drop goal, or one I should say is with Mrs. Leslie Barnes. I should mention that in case she reads it.
Well, she is an acknowledgement, Steve.
Will she read it?
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, we better.
She will read it.
I hope you've remembered to put it in there.
It's in there. Don't worry. She's read certain chapters and has actually thought I was a little bit hard on myself.
Okay. Well, some of us would have enjoyed that. but you know, who would be more lovable, unlovable from the outside than Gareth Chilcott, a man with a checkered career, on the pitch and in the nightclubs, you could say. You'd only have to sort of say a word to him on a rugby field and he'd lay you out sort of thing. That I think that's fair.
Hello would do to get
hello,
flattened.
Hello would do, yeah, and goodbye. But you were warmer about Coochie, as we call him, than almost anyone in the book. So one of rugby's greatest characters, and even your non-chronological, even the way you tried to do the book, you couldn't stop your affection for the bloke coming through.
No. And again, I don't like this. Oh, rugby is a game for all shapes, all sizes, people from all walks of life. But it's hard to believe any other sport where this sort of monster from Bedminster and this prima donna from Oxford University would end up being such good mates. But I guess Bath had a role to play as well as rugby in that we both were absolutely driven and obsessed with victory. We're both, I think most people know us, people with fairly sardonic tongues might be the right words, Steve. And we would lash each other. But I respected hugely what he could give me as a fly half, and Cooch certainly liked the fact that the fire and the fury that he stoked up with the likes of John Hall would actually turn into something because of the ability to make decisions. This is what rugby is all about. The other thing that I find so fascinating about Gareth is just the vast hypocrisy of rugby sometimes. He is one of the game's great characters. He is one of the lovable characters. But all these great and lovable characters, they tend pretty much to be people who have been in the front five. And a lot of the lovableness about them, Steve, when we go to rugby dinners, is the roguishness. You know, I touched the whole Willie John McBride. I went to South Africa and I trashed every hotel. And the boys in the city lap it up. If it was a footballer doing this, it would be tutted and scorned and a disgrace. But in rugby, even though now you know, nobody throws a punch. Everyone just grabs the jersey and they just threaten and there's nothing else. There was a period, there was a time when the people who were loved were the Chilcotts, the Jason Leonards of this world. And they were loved because they were nefarious and more often than not got away with it. And so when I hear colleagues in the media, when I hear fans, when I see young players saying, you know, this game has to be absolutely clean, I sort of think, OK, it needs to be clean, but that's not to say that we should be so politically correct as to admit that the fans who come love the intimidation, they love the physical violence of it. And to me, Steve, I think, and I think I touched on it in that Chilcot chapter, everyone, they love to punch and they love to stamp. And we as players understood there was a certain level. If you got your back raked, fine. If you got stamped in the head, you know, even if it was my best mate Chilcot, you'd be saying, what the hell have you done there? But now all of that has gone and it's been replaced with a, I think, a legalised violence. It's almost like the Colosseum. And when you stop and look back at it, and you're going to get berated for saying it, but I think that that's slightly out of control. Fiery punching and the odd boot made the game less damaging than this legalised violence now.
What? Let's just talk about the writing and journalism. You've obviously put a heck of a lot of time into this in terms of the way you're going to do it. And it is very, very singular. You also talk, use the phrase, the wilderness of freedom in the book, which is partly, I think, the philosophy that you live by. But the wilderness of freedom, is that also come from, or is part of that you've found in being a columnist? Because there is certainly a wilderness of freedom, but being a columnist, you have to have done it by a certain time. You have to have done it not the same as someone else has just filed it and all that sort of stuff. But it is a wilderness, because to come up with five ideas a week as you do is a freedom, but it's a real prison sort of freedom. It really is.
Well, I think we live in an age when people are encouraged to be herd-like in whatever we do. And when I write Wilderness of Freedom, I don't think it's easy to be truly free to say and believe what you want to do. And I love being a columnist for the simple reason that people say to me, you're being controversial. I honestly would say I haven't deliberately been controversial, or not very often in my life. I try and find something different that I believe in, and it irritates the hell out of a lot of people. And you know that better than me, Steve. But to be as much on your own as you can be, and to have your own independent views, I find it invigorating. I don't want people saying, oh, well done, we agree with you. It's a danger of broadcasting. And my chapter on television, I'm very concerned that ex-players come along and we're all part of the same gang of hey, it's all about Rugger. We don't broadcast. You shouldn't write for players. You should write for the intelligence of the viewers. And that's what I mean by a wilderness of freedom. And the easy thing to do is to go into the prison of just conformity.
First of all, though, just go back a little bit, then we'll come on to what you're saying, that you do wind people up. Okay, I do. So you do wind people up, and you can be contrary, but isn't that what the game is all about?
Yeah.
And providing you're not savaging someone either with inaccuracies or on personal lines, I'm afraid if you're not doing that, well, you couldn't sleep at night.
What's the point being a columnist?
No, there's not.
There's absolutely none. There's a golden rule, I think, which is to avoid the personal. I don't know what anyone gets up to in their lives, and I couldn't give a damn. But what they do once they take to the field of play, that's different. That's Stephen Jones and that's Stuart Barnes' terrain, and that's our job. And our job is not to be nicey-nice and to say, come on, Barnes, you played for Bath. Why are you giving so-and-so stick? Why aren't you being nice to the club? That is not the point at all of this. And I do relish it. I relish it because it's a job that forces you to think independently. And, You know, as I say, this takes me back. And this is why the book, Steve, couldn't have chronology, because there's a link between my frustration at crossing the Severn Bridge and becoming an English international without freedom, when I could have stayed and probably should have stayed and remained a Welshman who played with freedom. So I found in the writing of this book very interesting the various themes. They're sort of life themes, aren't they? Be you a journalist or be you a sportsman? And that was my point about being someone who is a protagonist within the game, but someone also who's outside it, writing about it.
Do you how do you measure the success or otherwise of ex-players who've come into the game in any form of journalism? I mean, I, for instance, say someone like Sam Warburton, who immediately has found his stride and is not being sick-making with former colleagues. Okay, he's not savaging them, but that's fine. But you've also got another lot who appear to think that even though they think they're journalists, they will criticise any journalist who offers an opinion because they haven't got any. Yeah. Now, does that piss you off? Because it pisses me off sometimes.
Listen, when I was very fortunate. When I joined Sky, and people might scoff at this, when I joined Sky a quarter of a century ago, I was very excited because they paid more than I'd ever been paid. But I was worried because I was afraid that people would say, right, you know, you've got to be nice about the game. It's never been in my nature to be nice about anything. If someone's good, I'll say you're great and I love someone, but I ain't going to be nice for the sake of it. And it was to my happy amazement that Sky gave a brief to be serious about sport. And I think that was certainly the case with their football. And they said to us, that the rugby department, you know, be serious about this. And I always believe that you've got to be serious. If you deal on something that is frivolous, you have to take it seriously. And Steve, what we do, it is only a game. If you can just mess around and be light-hearted about something that is a diversion, what the hell are we doing in our lives? So that really, really bugs me. And I feel now we are at another stage of sport. And sport now is competing not just football against rugby, against cricket, but against come celebrity, come dancing or something. And there's this constant rush towards being entertaining. And I am concerned that in broadcast in particular, it's become about entertaining and not enlightening. I think you've got to enlighten people if you're an ex-player, not just say, hey, our product's great all the time. I understand why it happens. There's a pressure commercially to do so, but I think it belittles the game. And after a while, you know, it will be something supported by people who just want 48, 47 matches because that's all they're being told. And the game is better than that, and it deserves more than that.
And just hope that all the youngsters who feel like becoming sports reporters, you keep pushing ahead, boys and girls, and you'll get there. We've been talking about Sketches from Memory, a rugby memoir by Stuart Barnes, published by Polaris in Edinburgh. And just as I said at the start, it's got no beginning, no end, no sense of chronology. He calls facts a false god. So I'm just going to go upstairs now to see Derek Clemens, our chief sub-editor, and I say, Derek, will you stop changing those facts so they're correct? Because they're false gods, obviously. Stuart, people will lap up your book. What are your favourite books that you've read?
Rugby books we're talking here. Yeah. I mean, they are in a minority. I think the other thing that's really important, Steve, if you talked about boys and girls who want to become sports journalists, first of all, read.
Yeah.
One or two ex-players said, what do I do to do what you do? I said, well, you've got to read. I said, I don't really like reading. I'm not very interested in language. I said, well, you're struggling. And I've got to say, I've got a real thing against... I'm not a big fan of ghosted columns. I believe in authenticity. And I think if you don't write it yourself, and that applies with autobiographies. If they're not written themselves, there's a slight weakness in that it's secondhand. And that's why when I come to my five favourite rugby books, none of them are ghosted.
Just go through your five.
Okay. I really enjoyed The Grudge.
Two votes for The Grudge already. By Tom English.
Tom English. He's what, two votes for Tom English? By Tom English or me?
We've both voted for Tom English.
It's it's a wonderful book. Really like that.
That's the book about the 1990
Grand Slam
that was for Scotland and wasn't for England. Yeah, okay.
Real life energy.
Yeah.
Very different as well.
Yeah.
A plug. I'm going to say Smelling of Roses, which was my first book, an autobiography. Now, I say this not because it was a thing of great art, but the first book of yours that you see on a bookshelf when it's up for sale, I'm sure you think the same, Steve, is a thing of beauty if you like work, if you like writing. So I love that. I'm going to say Endless Winter by your good self.
Well, you had to say that because otherwise I wasn't going to have you on the show.
I know that. It wasn't going to go to air, but it's a fantastic book. And again, it doesn't pull punches. It gets to the roots of what rugby is about. And then my last tin, one by the late, great Frank Keating, The Great Number Tens. I do not get a chapter, but I do get a mention. And I'm compared to a line from a T.S. Eliot poem. So thanks, Frank. And then my bolter is a book that was given to me by my great friend, mentor, and one of the world's finest coaches of them all, Brian Ashton. He gave me this book and he said, Stuart, don't worry about the date of it. Just read it and think about it. And it was an old book called King of Rugger by Lewis Jones, Welsh rugby union star who I believe, Steve, went north. And Brian said, read this and get a feel for the game. And on that note, you know, Brian said, feel for the game. And that's why my book is about a feel for the sport and not the facts.
It is indeed. My five is just to wrap up, Stand Up and Fight by Alan English about the Munster victory over New Zealand.
Oh, that's great.
Goodbye to Glory by Terry McLean. And very, very recently, Seven's Heaven by Ben Ryan, which is absolutely magnificent. Thank you so much for staying with us today. We'll be back on Monday. The big stuff's getting closer and closer. Please stay with us.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.